Hello, Charlie Clemos here, European Echo editor. You're listening to the European Echo podcast, a series of podcasts which I'll hopefully be doing with a few different people. Today I'm joined by Georgie Sinclair, founder and editor of ISO magazine. Hi, Georgie.
Hi, Charlie.
Given our interest, shared interest in urbanism, we're going to be doing a few podcasts on that theme, I imagine. Today it's, to start with, Red Vienna, and since it's me that's done some research on this today, Georgie's going to be asking the questions, so I expect the roles will reverse as we go. Georgie, questions. What have you got for me?
Well, okay, so Charlie, tell me, what is Red Vienna and what are we going to be talking about today?
Okay, yeah, we're going to be talking about Red Vienna, the period between 1918 and 1933 in Vienna, when there was a massive social housing program initiated in Vienna. First democratically elected socialist government. The things we're probably going to be touching upon is the precursor, the influence of the Vienna Werkstätte and Art Nouveau and the arts and crafts movement, and the effect that had on the style of housing and the attitude of the architects and the policy that initiated it. I also want to backtrack and talk about the experience I had going there. I went with one of my good friends, Jake, and we had very different approaches to how to experience the city. We'll probably move on to talking about houses as propaganda. This is obviously one of the main criticisms of socialism, is its use of policy to propagandize for socialism. I actually think that's one of the key strengths of socialist urbanism. We'll probably discuss that a little bit more. Really important, the relationship to value of the house building, which kind of links to the Vienna Werkstätte and the Art Nouveau movement and William Morris and John Ruskin's ideas, and how that developed as the period went on. And then we'll probably just like finish, if we've got time, on talking about the legacy and what we can learn about it.
Okay, so tell me about when you visited there, like what your experience was of the city and how you kind of navigated it.
Yeah, me and my friend Jake went to Vienna last year, 2015. We'd just been to Bologna, where we'd had a similar kind of interest in the architecture that was there. We had ourselves about 3 days in Vienna, and I took it upon myself. My idea of visiting Vienna was primarily, let's take as many pictures as possible of as many social houses as possible. Go to all the relevant museums, of which there's two, I think. There was an exhibition going on in the architecture museum at the time, and then there's a museum in Karl Marx Hof. To basically just kind of traverse the city and get as much done as possible. Jake, who's a very old good friend of mine, was much more inclined to take it easy, and was constantly pressuring me to have a little break, or we'd go and stop for a bit of coffee. And it was a friendly antagonism about whether or not we would do one or the other. I think it was our last day, and we decided finally to go to the Proletarian Ringstrasse, or Proletarian Ring Road, named as it is after the Ringstrasse, the sort of bourgeois Ringstrasse in Vienna, where most of the houses are. And I really, really wanted to do get in as much as I could towards the end. And we got to a point of Matteotti Hof, named after the Italian socialist who was murdered by the fascists in the early 20s. And we saw a cafe. Jake wanted to go in. I was being my usual crotchety self and not letting him do it. But we went in and met Jutta Schwartz, lovely lady who was kind enough to show us around in the final 2 hours that we were in the city. It's quite funny. We sort of sidled into the cafe, and the guy behind the cafe, as you do, asks what we were doing there. And we explained we were kind of looking into the houses, and he says, oh, you should go over there. There's a lady who's just been doing a series of tours. We kind of anxiously sidle up to her as well. And she sort of says that she's a bit busy right now. She's just finished the tours and come back in 2 hours. So I switch back into doing as much as possible mode, and we trudge across the city to go and see some more houses and then come back. Then take it easy with Jutta, and she shows us around. She grew up in the area. And this is really like a nice segue into sort of talking about the Vienna housing itself, which, because it's sort of an instructive point about the idea of doing as much as possible, this idea of cost effectiveness, of like my attitude of getting as much in as little time as possible. And Jake asking for a bit of coffee and a bit of quality time. If it wasn't for him, we wouldn't have discovered Jutta and we wouldn't have had as rich an experience. So it's a nice way of kind of really reminding what Vienna's about, or at least Red Vienna.
Yeah, okay. So we can talk about the influence, I guess, of the architecture and the architects themselves. One of the main architects of the period was Otto Wagner, is that right? Or it was more that the Art Nouveau movement influenced the architecture itself?
Yeah. Otto Wagner was active towards the end of the 19th century, which is around the time when Art Nouveau was kind of kicking off. Vienna was quite an interesting place at that time. Is probably at the forefront of modernism for various reasons, with Egon Schiele and Gustav Klimt in painting, and but really important in architecture and arts and crafts. Otto Wagner is probably one of the three, I forget the third, but in combination with Charles Rennie Mackintosh, three architects who really like initiate modernism. But at this point, I mean, his main innovation was this idea that the building should replicate the function that it's doing. It wasn't necessarily at this point form follows function, and it wasn't the sort of Adolf Loew's argument of ornament is crime.
Yeah.
There was still ornament, but it was a new idea that you should kind of not be so concerned with the tradition of how things should look, or how a building should look. Otto Wagner had a huge influence on the next generation of architects just by being a teacher of that. And one of them, I think probably contemporary, might not have been taught by Otto Wagner, was Joseph Hoffmann, who founded the Vienna Werkstatt.
Oh, yeah.
They're interesting because they try and take the reins of the problem that William Morris had with actually making arts and crafts and the idea of workshop labor cost effective. It eventually transpired that all his designs were being bought by wealthy people.
Yeah.
And as a Marxist, he obviously had a bit of a problem with that and never particularly resolved it. So the Werkstatt try and kind of do that. They've got a quite famous manifesto that talks about things like we will use copper leaf instead of gold, saying that they appreciate gold, but let's try and think about materials that will work just as well and that will preserve the kind of craft element.
It was more also as well that it was a kind of reaction against industrialization and the idea of mass production and mass-produced goods lowering the quality of the design product as well, I think.
Yeah. They say, like, the famous sort of quote is something like, we would rather spend 10 days on one object than produce 10 objects in one day. It's about basically trying to have, as you say, preserve the kind of the relationship that the worker had with their craft, that to... You know, it's this is a sort of period when industrialization was thought to be kind of dehumanizing, I suppose. I mean, it still is, but it's quite kind of crucial at that point. I think, like, yeah, you know, cities were kind of turning turning kind of productivity into the main sort of function of,
and also this like return to traditional craftsmanship is also providing these people jobs still. It's keeping the jobs and the sort of the labor force alive.
Yeah, this is probably quite a good way of feeding into the example of Red Vienna that we're discussing today. The idea of like full employment was like a really socialist sort of concept, rather than like producing as much for as little, which is a very capitalist formulation of the industrial process, that you should maximize the amount of profit margins, but rather actually refocus on, you know, giving people something to do and also producing some kind of accumulation of effects from the fact that someone is functioning in the economy and producing something and making themselves useful and making something beautiful.
So they adopted a direct labour programme.
And that has to have something to do with the kind of the point that we're at with huge social movements were obviously going to be influencing these architects at the time. Like the Socialist Party, even before it came to power, came to power off the back of very impressive sort of social organization. This sort of the kind of capitalist mode of production, that you maximize margins, was something to be fought against, and the artists doing what they do best and adopting these ideas were probably feeding quite, it was quite a mutually constituted situation at the time. So Red Vienna, obviously, like I can kind of return to my experience of sort of wandering around with Jutta and Jake. You know, you kind of, she one of the things that she was really like keen on doing was just like really kind of ferociously pointing at things that like elements, and she was quite at pains to say that it was about good materials and not about ornament and not about decoration, but about craft and kind of employing people to do different things. And she'd say like, look at these tiles, or look at this sculpture, or this aspect was for there's a nice picture we have of her standing where plays used to happen in the square of one of the places that she lived. I think she grew up in Herweghof, one of the social houses along the Ringstrasse. It was about employing as many people as possible, but doing like having them do interesting things, I think.
It's like avoiding the sort of Taylorist method of production, so that's sort of like prefabricated, or at least kind of the industrialized work process, which they wanted to sort of veer away from.
And interesting as well, because like this isn't just a capitalist thing as such. You have it later in the Russian example of house building, and also just system built housing in a lot of the Eastern Bloc as well as the West. Eventually that kind of idea of how things should be done, that you should just do as much as you can with as little as you can, and not really think about the sort of uplifting elements that a house can sort of offer you, that you kind of instead so Vienna was really like, it really was an experiment in like what is a home. It was a philosophizing about what, like how do we actually create a new kind of socialist way of living,
and that sort of participation that workers had in creating their own homes gave them probably a much more greater sense of ownership and a greater sense of sort of community within that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like it wasn't really, I should say as well, it wasn't they weren't just houses. I think Owen Haverly has a good section of his book Landscapes of Communism about the idea of the social condenser, that that these places were supposed to be be places where people met and things happened, and where social links were created, and where kind of where you would offer a library and laundry facilities and a school and kindergarten and like everything that in that's where social life happens. So there was a theatre, and in quite a few of them there's sports facilities or something like that, yeah. You know, and it was about allowing the people living there to kind of feel part of it in a way that yeah. they're not just atomized units that where things happen, you know.
It's kind of like micro communities. I think it's the same with the kind of like spatially speaking, they have quite big sort of squares in the middle as well, or sort of like green open spaces.
Yeah, like that was a sort of real like joy about being there was just the kind of like you would occasionally have like quite a few people around, but then there'd be these sort of spaces of tranquility where people could have a bit of privacy but still be kind of private but in public. And you'd also have this sort of monumentality of certain areas where, you know, you were supposed to be kind of encountering the amazingness of what these houses are. Reumannhof is like a good example of that, named after I think the first socialist mayor. Where it's a huge facade, and it's got his statue at the front, but it kind of hits you. And interestingly as well, this is where the last stand occurs in 1934, I think, maybe 33, where the socialist paramilitary against the fascist paramilitary kind of and
had a standoff.
Yeah, and they won there, but they got the call, and this was something that Jutta kind of sort of said with a note of sadness, I would say, that like they won there because Reumannhof was so well built for this kind of thing. It was almost as if these houses were actually built as
kind of as castles,
yeah, or fortresses, yeah. You know, that you kind of that you need to. That we've got this very precious moment where we're finally in power. We've organized, the social movements have happened, and we're here. Let's do as much as we can to kind of cement this and protect it, you know.
I think there's something quite interesting as well about where they are in the relationship of sort of the general layout of Vienna. They're quite centrally located.
Quite a lot of them, yeah.
Which kind of, I would guess it gives those like residents a kind of sense of a greater sense of not greater sense of community, but the sense of being not disenfranchised, I guess, and being involved within society and sort of the urban kind of experience.
Yeah, not
basically on the peripheries and being excluded and.
Yeah, similar, like, well, the opposite of something like the banlieue in Paris, yeah, or something like that, exactly. where they are, like, linked with, you know, and it's something that I think occurred earlier on in the period in London house building, with the LCC, you know, they deliberately tried to put sort of social housing next to private estates and things like that, to just sort of, to create this patchwork that you still see in London, although it's diminishing. But that, yeah, you know, by having these places in, I mean, they didn't, it's not like they knocked down the previous houses or anything like that. They tried to exploit spaces that were left over, and you do see sort of here and there, but also they appropriated houses. It's similar to the London situation.
Yeah.
And it's important to kind of, allude to things like the Southwark example now, where you've got like places like next to the Tate, where I'm pretty sure there was at least nearby, if not the area where Neobankside is, there were social houses. And then you've got sort of things happening in Elephant Castle, where the Haygate and Aylesbury estates are either, well, one knocked down, the other one under threat, or I think it's been saved. That you actually, at the moment, the Southwark Council's argument is we need to give up these central sites because then we can get more money and we can build houses elsewhere. And it's this like idea of like the idea that it doesn't really matter about something more than these just being houses that house people, and we do as much as we can with as little as we can spend.
Yeah.
That you actually are trying to create a socialist society, which is completely lost from London. But like, you still see it because of the strength of Vienna as a sort of because of Red Vienna, it's sort of how far it went. You still see that in Vienna. I think it's slightly diminished. I mean, we'll get to that with the legacy bit a little bit more. But yeah, it's a really important thing to think about, is that it didn't just occur on the periphery. They weren't just trying to build a new house. Well, I mean, which is quite remarkable, thinking about the point at which this happened. I think we were talking about earlier, like...
But I guess they didn't really have much other choice, right? There are so many people who are out of housing, and the reason that the socialist democrats came to power was because of the amount of people who needed to be paid attention to, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, I think, like, you say that, but, like, obviously, you know, I think... we've got an example contemporarily. Yeah, well, we've got an example contemporarily where there's terrible homelessness and the condition of housing in general in a lot of Western cities, London, Amsterdam, and so forth. Yeah. It is really probably not as dire in certain situations, although I wouldn't know. But it was off the back of social movements, But yeah, I mean, I think also they didn't have to pursue this policy of full employment and doing as much as possible and making kind of beautiful, well built houses. They could have adopted the idea of let's just house as many people as possible, not forgetting that I think it was in 1912 about 25% of the population were reliant on homeless shelters. Mm. We're talking to Jutta about this, like she didn't grow up in this time. She would have been, I think her mother was a child in the early period that this occurred. She I think was born in 1950s. But the period before this the Red Vienna period was characterized by huge amounts of homelessness, 25% reliant on homeless shelters, as I've said, but also during the First World War, a lot of the fighting was going on in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, particularly in the Czech Republic area. This wasn't the Czech Republic at the time, but of Galicia, and as a result, there was a massive influx of migrants, Czech migrants. Jutta's family were originally Czech migrants, and because of this, there was a massive demand, huge housing shortage and a massive demand. So landlords at this point during the First World War were, early on anyway, were charging whatever they liked. Mm. And you got situations where I think Jutta's family were in this situation where they were sharing a bed with another family. So it was like a 24-hour bed. Mm. They were using it all the time because they'd have a night shift and then a day shift, I suppose. And you also had people living on the banks of the Danube. There was like a kind of slum dwellings cropping up at that time. I think they introduced a peace, it was called a peace tax or a peace cap. So like a rent cap that still exists in certain forms today. Jutta was saying that she knows a friend of a friend who's inherited, because it can be passed on from through family. So they're paying some ridiculously low rent. But also, I think in that time they did start introducing caps so that things would be built.
And they also obviously adopted the housing tax, which was 40% of the building costs were taken from the housing tax, and then I think another 60% were taken from the luxury tax.
So yeah, these were new, quite progressive taxes that were being introduced to build all these houses. And
yeah,
I mean, like, so this is a situation where like there was a serious housing shortage, serious housing problem. As I said, I think they could have just built lots of houses, or not really tried to change the urban framework or the way that the house was understood. They didn't have to build collective facilities. They didn't have to build up. But I think, you know, after this point where they had kind of developed a social movement over a long period of time.
Mm.
They wanted to do something more, and you see it in the earlier houses in the period, and it does the actual quality of the architecture does diminish as the period progresses.
But that's an interesting point to segue into now then, because of how the durability of the buildings themselves and how they are still very eminent in the 21st century. And it's interesting to talk about the legacy that they have left behind.
Yeah, I guess.
And also the quality, actually, of the buildings themselves, you know, given that the idea was to produce high quality architecture, you can see that they are still very well maintained and very well used 100 years later.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like, I was really conscious of seeing places like Räumenhof, also Friedrich Engels Hof, obviously quite political names themselves. And these buildings are monumental, and they're also incredibly durable. They've sustained themselves, and in their very kind of presence, they are like they're a big kind of two fingers up to capitalist urbanism.
And this is also why they are, people often refer to them as pieces of propaganda in themselves.
Yeah, so it's like obviously like criticized on the whole that aspect of socialism, that it's trying to do something more than just helping people, right? It's trying to make them different, make them socialist citizens. This is kind of one of the things that the I believe one of the ministers in the socialist government, when Karl Marx Hof is opened, says we want to by surrounding workers with beautiful objects, we want to make them feel more beautiful. And yeah, I think I'm kind of all for that, you know, the
idea that they should be seen as propaganda, which isn't a negative thing as such.
No, I mean, it could be seen as condescending, of course, like as I've mentioned, but it's in the sort of situation we're talking about now, where there really is no real appreciation of what a house can do for a person's life, and how housing security and like beautiful solid housing can kind of make people think that their house is owned by them, I think, is really important. I think also just the monumentality of these places, it really reminds that something can be done with a very little amount of money. You know, that if we actually think differently about how value is sort of is understood, like you know, that it's that you can actually create additional value that's not measurable by currency, you know, by money and cost effectiveness, that you create these connections and you create this society that produces its own sort of and can reproduce more positive conditions and combinations, you know.
Yeah, so how can we compare the buildings or the housing developments that were going up in the same period in Red Vienna as with the sort of very stripped down modernist structures of the same period elsewhere?
Well, I mean, yeah, the important thing to note, I suppose, is that all these Red Vienna, but eventually all the Eastern Bloc failed in their kind of their ability to create something different. I think what we see in Vienna is, I think, like by creating something really like a beautiful object, a beautiful piece of architecture, that it becomes much harder to destroy that, know, that you need to create these objects that, and I mean, it really relates to the Lubetkin idea of nothing is too good for the working class. Right. And that you need to think that it's not, you should be lucky that you've got a balcony, or, you know, why are we wasting all this money on this? We just need to create as much as possible. And it's a slippery slope. And I think what Vienna was at least trying to do briefly is this island of like actually, you know what, like, it is possible to create something beautiful on a big scale for not, you know, like, not too much money, employ a lot of people, that has its own community building aspect, it accumulates value as it goes. And the problem, I guess, with the kind of stripped down modernism is that it's very easy to attack. As the sort of period in the West, planning kind of goes on, that there's this famous images of, like, the famous Pruitt Igoe project in St. Louis, Missouri, where it appears on the front of a magazine being demolished with the title "The Death of Modernism," and there's this discourse of that it was the design that. That was the problem, and that we should not think of houses as something that, like, that should be
stripped off all meaning and purpose.
And
that's actually very much what was going up in Berlin at the time, with sort of the Bauhaus architects were doing exactly that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, like, it's a slightly nuanced and tricky thing to kind of put black and white, that modernism was bad and that something slightly more decorative is more protected. But I think it's a good, what Vienna offers is, like, a certain, like, deviation from this modernist idea, and it sort of triggers in the mind this idea that actually it's not the idea of social housing, but the idea of, like, the willingness to maintain it. And I think it does, with something like Red Vienna, it does offer, people want to maintain that, you know. If you build something beautiful in the first place, but you will, I mean, it's hard, because the problem with the Pruitt Igoe project wasn't that it was modernism anyway. It was that that the maintenance wasn't in place. And you know, if you look at examples like if you look at the Barbican estate, obviously it's been maintained very well, and because it's a privately owned place. So it's complex, but the what I think Red Vienna is kind of successful at over the kind of mass built housing is that it's protected somewhat more from this threat, because it's not as conspicuously ugly or difficult to get on board with. Nobody argues about the sort of pleasantness of Rabenhof or Friedrich Engelshof. It might be monumental and slightly propagandistic, but it's a good piece of propaganda.
Is there evidence of the residents' sense of pride at the time in the period, or is it very much are we looking back on this with a bit of nostalgia and kind of assuming that this is what everyone believed? There also maybe some sort of retaliation against it? I mean, were they providing enough housing? Was it fulfilling their desires and their needs?
I think definitely. There definitely was a reaction. It's an interesting example is the Amalienbad washing baths, which are now kind of held up as a masterpiece of Art Nouveau design. The kind of thing that probably just you wouldn't get a building like that, public building, in most other places now. And it's so beautiful. I actually didn't get a chance to go inside. I've only seen pictures of it inside, but from the outside, it's also nice. But at the time, it was one of those. I mean, you could see it featured in the Sun newspaper or, you know, a tabloid now saying, you know, like, why have we paid public money for this ridiculous extravagance? You know, and you had so you have a report at the time where I guess the sort of bourgeois press is kind of. Is basically saying that is saying this is a waste of money, and obviously, like, it's harder and harder. I think probably you exploit these openings where, which is what the socialists were really good at very initially, is that they built loads very quickly and they did it beautifully. But as the period wears on and the 1929 depression kind of. The ripple effect of that. It's harder and harder to justify that, and then you get like I guess the right wing gets slightly more organized, fascist paramilitaries kind of intervene, and The socialists have their own paramilitary, but this is what kills Red Vienna in the end.
So there's a sort of uprising of the sort of bourgeois and kind of sort of fascism or Austro-fascist parties or movements that basically try to take down.
I mean, that's like it's a very similar, although less known, series of events to what happens in Germany, where you have a collaboration of the wealthy and the landlord class and small petit bourgeois elements, and the rural religious elements in the rest of Austria kind of combine to the socialists lose power nationally early on in the period, but then Vienna remains socialist and has to be. It's a sort of civil war situation where, as I said, the last stand occurring in Reumannhof, and it's really, I mean, it would be hugely damaging of them to have done it, but it's really great that they survived that period, the houses. You know, it's that's the great thing about houses, is that they're both, they can be both incredibly useful and popular, but also beautiful. So it's hard to get rid of them. What do you do? I suppose you could remove the statues of the socialists and the plaques, and but they're still there, all of them. And there's this design workers imagery and things like that
which would suggest that there is some element of, or huge element of pride that still subsists.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, to return to the sort of situation me and Jake found ourselves in when we actually approached Jutta, she was in conversation with two younger girls from the neighbourhood, which has now become predominantly Turkish, I believe. I might be wrong. But they had organised a sort of series of, it was drama workshops and tours to encourage young people to really realise the value of what's going on there. And I think, like, the fact that that's happening is really great. It's really like, it's a really nice kind of thing to see, I suppose. I don't want to be too condescending. But.
So, I mean, the legacy stands and the sentiment still, it still presides. Like, people still feel the same way today and use it in the same way as it was originally intended.
It's hard to say. I mean, like obviously there's elements of that and the fact that it's still there, as I've kind of repeated, but I kind of really want to emphasize, I suppose, as a sort of concluding statement, that the fact is, as I'm kind of echoing what I said before, that these places ended up experiments ended.
It's a very relatively short-lived period.
1918 to 1933, and really the sweet spot is in before 1929. So it's only a 10-year period, and it's amazing what they did. But you really do have to. This is the problem with municipal socialism in general, is that it's these islands of socialism that eventually have to succumb to the pressures of everything else outside it. And I think all these experiments. This is my kind of, I'd like to think, closing statement would be like that these experiments don't really go far enough. Like, they obviously offer something. They offer you this moment of like, this is what the future could be, but when you don't abolish private property, at the end of the day, the forces that are against socialism are going to rally and they're going to overcome it. And I think really the lesson is, like, we don't want to repeat that. We don't want to repeat Red Vienna exactly. It's a great period that is much, much more beautiful. Many more houses were built under much more difficult circumstances than we have now, although things are getting worse. Great example of what can be done. But if you don't abolish private property, then I think the fundamentals of capitalist urbanism still survive and they still return. I think that's why these experiments don't last very long. The European Echo podcast was brought to you by European Echo. The theme was Cash by Jim Clemmose. If you like this podcast, why not head to iTunes and subscribe, and maybe tell some other people about it.